As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Now, for the City of London, Bob Dimond joins us. To say he's founding partner and CEO of Atlas Merchant Bank barely describes what he did for Barclays. I'll cut to the chase because of time. Go back and look. Did Barclays get a bailout during the crisis? Bob Dimond, thank you so much. Honored to have you here in our studios with Bloomberg today. I'm going to ask one question on the city because John really wants to focus on Sterling. There's the city. There's this comedy of Reaganomics redux as well. How does the city, as an international venue, how does it move forward? How does it survive as the global institution?
So this is a really important question, Tom. And I think with all the debate around the announcements that were made in the last couple of days, there is much more support for the city. Something as simple as removing the bankers' bonus caps, which, as you know, was gamed by the banks and put the UK banks at a significant competitive disadvantage to the US banks. Any support for the city right now is important.
But what else would you like to see from this government to bring that kind of enthusiasm back to the city that I think was lost for many people after the Brexit vote?
You know, I think right now credibility is the key. And Simon French said this morning that the only currency that Simon French from Panmure Gordon, the only currency that really matters in the UK macro right now is credibility. And I think the announcement earlier today, which I saw in the Bloomberg headlines, which is that the chancellor is going to spend time with the banks and the traders and distributors of the gilt market is important. So I think step one is credibility. Jonathan, if you put this in context, we had $150 billion debt-financed energy policy without really preparing the gilt market for what was coming in terms of issuance. And I think people talk about the currency crisis. I think this is more a crisis in the gilt market than it was in the currency market.
Well, can you talk a little bit more about what some of those moves in rates would mean for a big bank running a large mortgage book? We saw certain banks remove certain products in the last 24 hours. You, of course, had to oversee a large mortgage book over at Barclays in your time running that bank. But can you tell me what you'd have to do when you see rates move this quickly, this fast, and expectations for the Bank of England climb as quickly as they have done?
Well, if you put it in context, Jonathan, the two-year gilt as recently as August was about 1.5%. You know, right now it's about 4.25. I think it touched 4.5 in the last couple of days. So to your point, that's a sizable move. That kind of volatility is not necessarily bad for banks, particularly banks with investment banking operations such as Barclays. But what it will do is it will really slow down the issuance of any new mortgages. So the mortgage books in terms of new issuance, it's going to be, as you said, there was the announcement that a number of banks have really kind of closed their mortgage issuance.
Bob, it's also going to slow down the economy dramatically. What are you expecting in terms of a downturn, a potential response from England, given that the fiscal tool is kind of being blown up and the Bank of England kind of has to push back?
So let's keep it in context. I talked about, I think the communications and the credibility around announcing $150 billion debt-financed energy policy, we talked about those issues. But the other things that were announced, there's some good things in there. I think the announcement around both corporate and personal taxes, Keeping corporate taxes at 19% or lowering them 19% rather than raising them to 25% puts the UK in a credible position amongst its peers. I think announcing some easing of immigration to ease the labor supply issues. I think some of the things that were announced around kind of infrastructure or reducing the bureaucracy to be able to get to building around infrastructure and around housing. So keeping it in context, there were some positive things that were announced within this. And I think because of the shock to the debt markets, to the gilt markets, we really have to find a way to hold the hands of the markets until late November when the budget is announced. And we really get to look at what is meant here by the medium and long-term fiscal program. And somehow we have to manage our way through these markets. And I think the chancellor meeting with the banks today and over the next couple of days is a positive step in that direction.
Do you see some opportunities then?
Absolutely.
Where are they, Bob?
Within the gilt market? Within
sterling-denominated assets more broadly. Take your pick.
Well, look, Jonathan, I want to put that in context as well. People have talked about the currency crisis. The move from 130 down to where the currency is right now has really been about the dollar, the dollar, the dollar. So the UK currency is down maybe 25 or 30%. The dollar's up 20% against every currency in the world. So we need to keep that in context.
Bob Diamond of Atlas Merchants Capital.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Right now, we are going to stop worldwide and have a conversation with a definitive expert on EM. Arguably, with Stanley Fischer, he invented our concept of emerging markets. This is a guy where Damian Sassauer of Bloomberg hangs on every word. Mark Mobius was a communications major who got parchment from MIT years ago and basically invented for Sir John Templeton the emerging market business. We're honored that Mark Mobius joins us from Dubai this morning. Mark, just what a pleasure to have you with me. Let me cut to the chase that every pro wants to know. How close are we to the instabilities of 1998 or 1992?
I think we're very close, actually. We're in a really a strange situation because on the one hand, you've seen this incredible increase in money supply. And my definition of inflation is devaluation of currency. And if you increase money supply by 40%, as we've seen in the U.S., then that's what the devaluation of the money is going to be. And of course, that's where prices are going to go. But we're in a very strange situation now because we've got these cryptocurrencies. And here in Dubai, I noticed that there's so many people transferring money in cryptocurrencies. And if you look at the emerging markets in particular, places like Nigeria, they do a tremendous amount of turnover
right.
in cryptocurrencies.
Mark,
so, what is money supply? That's a big question, Mark.
Right. I look, Mark, and you and I were on a stage at the Waldorf Astoria, I'm going to say 8 years ago, and you stuck your neck out and said, baloney, that the rules have changed for EM. There's this this conceit right now that EM is more financially solid. EM has their act together, unlike 1998. Do they?
It depends on the country. That's the great thing about emerging markets. You see such variety. You see some countries that are doing a terrific job. By the way, Brazil, which used to be a basket case, has been doing a pretty good job in stabilizing the economy. And then you go to a place like Taiwan, even Indonesia, they've been doing a very good job in managing their economies. So it really depends on where you're going. And then you go to Turkey, and then you have tremendous amount of devaluation of the Turkish lira, and really a lot of instability financially. But there are even opportunities in Turkey.
So, Mark, at this point, you started by saying that there are some analogs to 1998, that we're getting close to that. What's the dividing line between now and then, the trigger point that makes this devolve into something that needs to be immediately addressed rather than just a rapidly evolving ball of pain for debt investors?
The real situation now is that, unlike what we had in the past during the Asian financial crisis, is that the dollar debts are not as big as they were, because a lot of these countries learned their lesson. It was not a good idea for them to get into dollar debt, so they realized that and didn't do it, except for a number of countries that have been involved in the Belt and Road projects that China has been doing, where they've lent an awful lot of money in renminbi and dollars to these countries, which they can't pay. So here again, you have tremendous differences between countries. And in some cases, as I say, we're closer to these Asian financial crisis kinds of situations.
Mark, I'm glad that you brought that up, the Belt and Road initiative of China, which by some accounts has significantly soured. There was one report recently, it was published in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, that nearly 60% of China's overseas loans are now held by countries considered to be in financial distress, up from 5% back in 2010. This really raises a concern for China, which has acted more like a banker than, say, the IMF when it comes to these types of loans. How does this develop, Mark? How does this evolve into something that could potentially have contagion effects in markets? Are there countries that are going to just basically be flat on their backs, unable to pay their bills that you're looking at?
There are a number of countries in that situation. I was in Sri Lanka 6 months ago, and of course, they're flat on their backs. They can't pay, and they owe the Chinese so much, and of course, they owe other donors. The problem is that nobody knows what the numbers really are, because the Chinese signed agreements with these countries that they should not disclose. They cannot disclose what they owe and what the Chinese lent to them. So we're really in a dark spot. And if you talk to IMF people, they're really very unhappy about the situation.
Mark, I've got a fancy chart, really fancy chart, that's a very weak extrapolation of how we get to another Plaza Accord. And the naive chart is 2032. I don't buy it for a minute with the rates of change, first and second derivative dynamics that we see right now. How close are you and I to having a beverage of our choice at the Plaza Hotel?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question, because here you have the dollar so strong, okay? And prices in America are not down. In fact, I just took a one-month trip all over America, and people are spending like crazy. Then you go to London. Now, the pound has devalued against the dollar by, what, 30%? And yet, try to find a hotel, a decent hotel in London, below 300 or 400 euros or 400 pounds. It's crazy, the whole situation. And that's why I say I think we're in a situation where nobody really knows what the money supply is. And I believe a lot of this is because of the crypto world.
Mark, you've got standards. I'm guessing you're looking for a different kind of quality hotel compared to many of us. I mean, you can't do five-star
really.
London for like £300 anymore, Mark. Times have changed. It's not just inflation.
I usually stay at the chain hotels. And by the way, in the U.S., I checked into a Marriott, and the front desk asked me when I was checking in, do you want maid service? I said, what do you mean? I said, we don't give maid service unless you ask for it, and it's only every 7 days.
Only every 7 days.
That's like Pharaoh's house.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would work for me, Mark. Mark, I wanted to bring up Raphael Bostic of the Atlanta Fed on the UK. And Lisa, I want your view on this. He was basically asked about what was happening in the UK at the moment and whether it adds to the odds of a global recession. And he turned around and said it doesn't help. And I just wondered what the rest of the world would like to say back to the Federal Reserve, Lisa. If people are worried about the UK not helping, I mean, surely the Federal Reserve and aggressive rate hikes and a strong dollar is a bigger threat to the global economy than what is going on in the UK.
Well, and that's actually perfect segue, Mark, into what you're looking for in terms of some of the distress that you're focused on for some sort of response from the Federal Reserve, some sort of concerted effort like Tom was talking about. Basically, is there a cap on how much pain there can possibly be? Is there a trade that you're looking at?
I don't think the Fed is going to care about the markets. They're going to care about inflation. That's their first priority. And their playbook is to keep on raising rates until the rate is above inflation, which means you're talking about 9%. Inflation now 8%. Now, if you look at the UK, to be fair, they have been reducing money supply. Of course, they raised it as much as the U.S., but the U.S. money supply is still up there. It's not really going down that much. So I think we're in a situation where the playbook for the Fed is going to continue, means they're going to continue raising rates. And the market is just going to have to live through it. And by the way, let's be reminded, high rates don't mean a bear market. I mean, there have been many cases in history where the rates were high, but we had a good, you know, a good bull market. So we have to watch that space carefully.
Mark Mobius, great to catch up. Got to catch up with you at short notice too. Mark Mobius, thank you, sir, of Mobius Capital Partners.
William Dudley joins us now, the former Fed president. He's been of uncommon value before, during, and after Jackson Hole. Bill Dudley, markets are moving. The litmus paper of the system, the 10-year real yield, has gone from the bottom 83% up to the pre-Great Financial Crisis level of about a 2.05. How do fancy people like you interpret where the real yield is, how far the real yield has come, and how it nears what seems to be some form of historic normal?
I think it tells you that the Fed is finally getting its arms around making monetary policy tight. Chairman Powell talked about how it needed to see real yields positive throughout the yield curve, and the Fed is moving pretty quickly in that direction. And 75 basis points last week, and they're promising another maybe 125 basis points before the end of the year, taking the federal funds rate well above 4%. So the Fed is catching up. And I think the question at this point is, will they stay the course until they've actually finished the job to get inflation back down to 2%? Paul says he'll do that. But whether the rest of the FOMC will come along with them, I think, is an open question at this point.
You, like Richard Clarida, who joined us on Fed Day, know the mathematics, the physics of modern economics, and then you discard it to real-world application. You did that at Goldman Sachs for decades and then at the Fed. I want to talk about the inertial force in this odd word, overshoot. Is it a requirement or is it efficacious that a central bank overshoot a given target?
Well, ideally, you don't overshoot. You do just enough to achieve your objectives. But as you know, monetary policy has a lot of long lags in terms of its effects on the economy, and it's hard to judge those effects in real time. I think the Fed is probably going to be ultimately overshoot a bit because they've said that the risks are skewed. The risk of doing too little is much greater than the risk of doing too much, because if you do too little, you end up in the 1970s with a more entrenched inflation problem, and then you have to do even more later. So I think, you know, this is the consequence of the Fed being late. If you're late, you have to catch up. If you catch up, you probably are going to overshoot. If you overshoot, you're going to have a recession. I think where I would fault the Fed right now is I don't think they've been realistic about the pain that they're actually going to cause. If you look at their forecast last week, the unemployment rate climbs a little bit. It climbs up to 4.4%, and then inflation melts away. I don't think it's going to be quite so simple as that. There's never been an example of the unemployment rate rising from 3.5% to 4.4%, 0.9 percentage point rise. If it rises more than a half a percentage point, every time that's happened in the post-World War II period, the U.S. has ended up in a full-blown recession. And the smallest rise in the unemployment rate in those situations is 2 percentage points. So I think the Fed is understanding the pain involved. What worries me about that then is that people, when the pain actually arrives, people will start to pressure the Fed not to follow through.
And this is the point of the column that you wrote today, that there seem to be some doubts in your mind and in markets' minds right now, if the market had a mind, that the Fed is going to stay the course. What do you think they have to do to come out and say they're going to stay the course? Or do you think they're not going to, that they're going to pull back on some of the rate hikes, say, if unemployment rises above 4.5%?
Well, I think Chair Powell is committed to staying the course. I think he's, you know, studied history and knows the consequences of not doing enough. But whether it can bring the rest of the Federal Open Market Committee along with them later. I mean, right now it's easy to be tough, right? Because everybody wants to get inflation down. The labor market is still very strong. And so the pain hasn't really materialized yet. A year from now, when the unemployment rates were considerably higher, the economy has slowed, inflation's come down a bit, there's going to be people who are going to start to argue, do we really need to push inflation all the way back to 2%, or can we take a break now?
And how much is this going to be a political pressure on the Fed?
Well, I think the Biden administration will be pretty good about guarding the Fed's independence. Typically, if an administration starts to pick on the Fed, that just unnerves financial markets, and that makes the central bank's job even harder. So I would be surprised if the Biden administration, you know, started to attack the Fed. But you already are hearing, you know, cries from the left wing of the Democratic Party about how unfair this is, that low-income workers are going to be put out of work, you know, as if there's some alternative. The problem here is that once you're late, you have to catch up. Once you're late, the unemployment rate has to go up. There are no other alternatives. And so it's not as if the Fed has a better path to achieve better outcomes. They need to do what they need to do to get inflation back down. It's just going to be difficult.
If we see services stabilize and maybe reduce, if we see goods come down to the goods disinflation or deflation that we saw pre-pandemic, I guess that means we come back towards John Taylor's 2%. Are you wedded to 2.0%, or can Bill Dudley construct a new normal at 2.8, 2.9, 2. Adam Posen? Where do you stand on that, Bill?
Well, I'm not sure, Tom, if you're talking about the real interest rate or inflation.
Well, I'll go either way. I'll let you make it up. But okay. To me, it's just a level that we're aspiring to get to out there.
I think. Yeah, there are some people that say the Fed should raise their inflation target, but I think that's a bad approach right now, because that's like moving the goalposts because you can't achieve your objective.
Done that.
So I think that would undercut the Fed's credibility a lot. And I think Powell has been very clear that his pursuit of 2% inflation, from his perspective, is unconditional. Whether he can bring the rest of the FOMC along with him when the job starts to become more difficult is really the fundamental question. Right now, markets basically believe Powell. Inflation expectations stay well anchored, but the pain process that's about to unfold is just begun.
That's the domestic pain. The international pain we're witnessing right now, Bill.
Well, that's happened already. Yes, absolutely.
So I wonder, Bill, how you think they should respond to that, if at all.
Well, you know, the reality is they're not going to respond to that, because at the end of the day, monetary policy in the U.S. is about what's best for the United States in terms of the Fed achieving its U.S. inflation and output of and employment objectives. Obviously, this creates a lot of pressure on the rest of the world. You know, the stronger dollar holds down U.S. inflation. A weaker foreign currency increases inflation. So the flip side for other countries is much, much tougher.
Messi, Bill, fantastic to catch up. Great piece as always, sir. Bill Dudley there, the former New York Fed president and Bloomberg opinion columnist.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I remember you telling me Ryanair, it's three whatever on the Irish RYAID. You said buy it at three, and it went 3 to 18. I mean, that's what Ryanair did.
Did you buy it?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I mean, and it's been down in pandemic and all that, and somehow survives to move forward, and does so with one of the most extraordinary chief executive officers, Mr. Michael O'Leary, who's been medicated over the last 3 days and joins us this morning. Michael, John and Lisa have some very important British questions. I want to ask you what matters to every viewer and every listener right now, and you own the high ground on this. If we don't fly business class, we won't fly. This new addiction to business class versus economy, which you own the high ground on, where are we in a couple years with our addiction to business class, like New York to Paris, $18,000?
I mean, it's a good question, but you know, there's two different markets here. Business class will continue on long haul. You know, it's a different business model, but business class has disappeared on North American domestic, and business class has disappeared on trans-European as well. People will not pay a ludicrous premium on 1 and 2 hour flights to be stuck in some hub airport that looks like resembles the black hole of Calcutta, as Heathrow, Schiphol, and Paris Charles de Gaulle have much of this year. Happily, the vast majority of European passengers have switched sensibly to Ryanair for the most on time flights, the lowest airfares, and a brilliant and safe service.
Every time we speak, Michael, there's always a pitch. There's always a sales pitch. Let's talk about immigration, Michael, and this new government. You've complained about it for so, so long. We've got an opportunity for change. What do you want to see happen?
Well, you're particularly talking about the UK government.
I am, yeah.
The latest version. Okay. The UK government, Brexit has been the greatest economic foot shooting in the history of economic development since the Second World War. It is the stupidest, dumbest economic activity known to mankind. It was led by Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, and a number of other legendary idiots who decided that the way forward for the UK economy was to leave the biggest trading bloc in the world. Now, you know, but there's no point in arguing over Brexit. Brexit has happened. But at least if you're going to leave the European Union, leave with the most intelligent free trade agreement in place with the European Union. Of course, what these morons did was they left with the worst trade agreement in place. And they have the remarkable situation that we are, and we're one of the biggest employers in the UK. We employ more than 8,000 pilots and cabin crew in the UK. This year, all of the airlines are struggling to recruit people because a lot of the English people don't want to work in a service industry like the airline industry, despite our high pay. We couldn't get visas for Europeans. They would give us visas for non-Europeans, but not for Europeans, because they want to take back control of their border. Now, they don't have much control because there's about 1,000 refugees each day coming across in dinghies from France. Apparently, they're fleeing persecution in France. Who knew that France was such a terrible country? But it is the UK is currently a country that has no labour policy, and the restrictions in the labour market are inhibiting growth, never mind the crazy budget they've just announced last week.
Michael. It's clear that you have some pretty strong feelings about this. I can say that. And it's nice that you can share them with us. Your perspective as one of the biggest employers in the United Kingdom, how much, as things are now with the labor policies currently in place, how much have wages gone up on average for you? And do you expect them to keep climbing with no change into the year?
Funny enough, wages haven't gone up that much. I mean, there's clearly upward pressure on wages because of pay inflation. But, you know, the challenge for a lot of industries in the UK, whether it's retail, hospitality, air transport, is wages haven't gone up because nobody wants to do the jobs. Even if you increase the pay, people still don't want to do the jobs. We're bringing in people from Morocco and from Turkey, and we can get visas for those guys to work in the UK. But they won't give us visas for Portuguese, Italians, Germans, and Polish people. It's a crazy system. But I'm pleased to say that lots of people are fleeing the UK. All of them are flying with Ryanair on very low airfares to more than 200 destinations all over Europe and saving a fortune, making a fortune, taking up well-paid jobs all over Europe.
Michael, I don't think Liz Truss is calling you anytime soon after this one.
I bloody hope not.
But revenue at Bloomberg's going to call for the two advertisements.
Michael, I want to squeeze in a foreign exchange question if we can.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me as a CEO, given the moves we've seen in pound sterling, in the euro, given some of the costs in US dollars, how have you hedged any of that? What have you done? Have you had to adjust to that story?
Yeah, I mean, the UK sterling, we're reasonably insulated because we have, we essentially balance our sterling revenues with sterling costs. As I said, like, we employ about 8,000 people in the UK. We have a lot of airport and handling costs in the UK. We are short euros, long dollar. Thankfully, in Ryanair, we've been very fortunate. We've hedged our dollar exposure on all of our capex. We've ordered more than 200 aircraft from Boeing out to 2026. We hedged all that at 124 dollar euro 124. So we are significant beneficiaries of that. I think the real challenge for a lot of our competitors in Europe is they're not hedged on the dollar, and therefore they're paying about 25% more in terms of cost for their aircraft and their spares. Thankfully, we've largely hedged on CapEx. Our OpEx is hedged out until the middle of 2023, which would largely be oil. And we hedged the oil as well. So we bought for out to next April at about $64 a barrel. So we've been lucky and fortunate in being very well hedged, but a lot of our competitors in Europe who are buying US dollar assets, and for the airline industry, aircraft fuel and spares are all in dollars. It's a very difficult time.
Michael, let's spend some more time next time, a longer conversation about the mess that Europe is in. And you let me know if the Prime Minister gives you a call.
Europe is okay. Europe is growing strongly, and Europe will do well as long as
Germany right now, Michael. I'm sure other people might have a different view on that. Michael O'Leary of Ryanair.
Let's get right to an important conversation. Within your collective gloom, Victoria Fernandez says no. Chief market strategist at Crossmark. She is in the trenches of what do you actually do with money. Victoria, you say no to cash. Why?
Yeah, I mean, look, Tom, when we talked a couple weeks ago, we had increased our cash position a little bit because we felt like we would get some inflection point, and that would be an opportunity to go in and shift the portfolio a little bit. And so that's what we're doing. We're using up that cash. We're putting a little more beta, a little more cyclicality into our portfolios. I'm not a raging bull at this point, but I think you can take a little defense out of your portfolio and start building it up again as we're probably getting closer to a bottom. We haven't hit a lot of those metrics that people are looking for. We have a negative earnings yield. You typically don't hit a bottom with a negative earnings yield, but we're also not in there trying to time the bottom exactly. We think use some of the events like we've seen this week to start building more positions in your portfolio.
Does that mean buy the banks?
So we're not buying banks per se, but we are buying credit cards. We like Visa. We like American Express. We're buying some of the energy names, too. As you know, we've been underweight energy for a while, and we've been building that position. But we've added quite a bit. We've added to Phillips 66, ExxonMobil, Valero. We've gone in and added a lot to those names. And even more cyclical names like UPS. I know a lot of people didn't want to be in the space after the things that FedEx said, but we think that that was more idiosyncratic for FedEx. And we think there's some opportunity in the fourth quarter for a company like UPS as well.
What about Facebook, Google, Amazon?
Yeah, so those high-flying tech names, those communication services names, I think that's really where you've got to be careful. We have some exposure to those FANG names, but it's not an area that we're adding to right now. I think you have to be very careful on those because there's probably more downside as yields continue to go higher on those. I think if you're going to play in that space, Apple is probably your safer bet at this point in time. They just closed out their fiscal year end over the weekend. And from what we're seeing from analysts, they had a pretty strong year. So I know a lot of people are waiting for Apple to make the big turn to say we've hit the bottom. I'm not sure we see that in their earnings coming out after this quarter end.
Victoria, I want to understand your parameters. We've been talking a lot about the Fed pivot and whether that's sort of underpinning some of the bullish sentiment that we hear on the fringes of Wall Street, not necessarily mainstream. What's underpinning your conviction that we're getting close to a bottom?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the momentum that we've seen, the trend lines that we're watching. There's a lot of contrarian signals out there. You look at the bull bear ratio. You look at the put call spike ratio. I know that Tom was mentioning the VIX earlier this morning, and we're surprised the VIX isn't higher than where it is, but we want to see the VIX continue to move higher in the with a three handle. So I think you have to look at a lot of these trends and say we're getting close to where we think we need to be.
Victoria, Crossmark's clients, like everywhere else, are absolutely shell-shocked with the news flow, all the nuances of it. It comes down to revenue and the dynamics of unit and price. How important is revenue into this earnings season?
It's extremely important because it's going to tell us what the margins look like. I mean, one of the themes that we just talked about last week in our investment committee for all of our strategies was quality. Quality of earnings and quality of balance sheet. And so revenue is highly important. We know with prices being higher, that top line will be there. It comes down to what do those margins look like? And look, EPS, the expectations for this quarter have come down from north of 9% to right around north of 3% for the quarter. But I still think they're going to be strong enough to hold up the market until the Fed pushes us over a cliff.
John, Victoria's next investment management committee happens to be in the great state of Alabama. It's Texas A&M Alabama.
Nice.
That's happening October 8th. You think we could make it down
I've been
to
wondering
meet the good
for a while.
People across, Mark?
I want to go and watch Bama play, Tom. I'm told it's the closest
A&M,
thing to European
Victoria
football.
Victoria Fernandez, come on, it works.
Victoria,
on,
can we make that happen?
Let's go. Y'all come on down.
We're going to do a surveillance special. Do you like that, Tom?
You all
come
absolutely.
On down. I feel like Victoria put that on just then.
The fighting Texas Aggies.
Victoria Fernandez, across Mark Global Investments. Love that.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.